Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson that helps you be better briefed. I'm Andy Phillip, and on this week's episode, we're joined for a featured interview on the early days of a big election year. Jennifer Lees Marshmint is an expert who focuses on political marketing and management of parties. Her insight began around 20 years ago by looking at the rise of Tony Blair's New Labour. Since then, she's published books and worked in New Zealand before returning to the UK and to Dundee University at the start of this year. The timing's fantastic for us, as you can hear in her interview with politics reporter Alistair Clark shortly. Jennifer talks about Labour's challenges, particularly in Scotland. She reflects on the SNP's tricky gamble on making this an independence-focused vote, and she gives her view on what might happen to the Conservatives while fringe parties such as Reform try to peel away at the right. She's also got interesting views on the problems baked into our democracy. Politicians market themselves to victory, but then have zero training of actually doing the job of governing. Would you go to a surgeon who wasn't trained to operate? Why should we expect to be governed well by MPs who promised their way to victory? Alistair began by asking how the phony war sets the scene for an election year where we still don't have a date with destiny. Is a thumping Labour majority really a foregone conclusion?
First of all, my experience in elections taught me never to take anything for granted or to be certain. But also, if we look at more detailed polling, it's not as clear cut. So how I would summarise it is voters are extremely dissatisfied with the Conservatives, not just in that sense of it's time for a change, but also because of the turbulence in terms of leadership, their questions over their management of the COVID pandemic and so on, and also the fact that the economy and inflation is not doing well, which is normally Conservative strength. So they're very dissatisfied with the Conservatives, and all the polling data shows that in many ways, not just Conservative versus Labour and not just the leader, but also things like, is the country heading in the right direction? No, it's not. A large number think it's not. And they don't think that Rishi Sunak has delivered either. However, that doesn't mean they're satisfied with Labour as an alternative offering. When you look at more detailed polling, such as from YouGov, you see that although Keir Starmer, the leader, is ahead of Sunak in that he's more popular than Sunak. He's not very popular. Normally, for a new leader of an opposition party coming into power, such as Blair did in 1997, normally, or Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, normally they're flying high in the polls and they have what we call brand likability, where people see them as likable, they see them as trustworthy and competent. And there's a very strong majority of voters who would see Keir Starmer as positive on those measures. But according to the YouGov data and other data, that's not the case. So voters, you know, Keir Starmer is not as popular a leader as you would expect. And then there's, you know, a few other indications. So on one hand, you know, 69% of voters think the Conservative Party is out of touch. So that shores up the idea they're going to lose. But on the other hand, 44% of voters think that Labour's out of touch. So that's not an overwhelming majority of support for voters. So I think one of the problems is that Labour spent so much time attacking the Conservatives and highlighting their weaknesses rather than spending time saying what they're going to do. In politics, it's really important that opposition parties, if they're going to win control of government, don't just talk about what's wrong with the existing government, but they offer their alternative product. You know, so it's like in business, right? You wouldn't buy a product of somebody who just went on and on about how the other alternative competitive provider was, you know, you wouldn't buy this car because somebody else says that car's bad. You know, you want to know what is it that they're going to offer that's going to be fresh. You need to connect with and feel in touch with the leader, and then you need to believe they're going to be able to deliver it because, you know, Rishi Sunak set various pledges and he hasn't delivered on all of them. So why would Keir Starmer be different? So the Labour Party can't take it for granted. They've still got a lot of work to do to convince voters that they are the party that can come into power and not just have nice ideas that to address the problems, but actually be able to deliver them and actually make a difference in people's lives that's positive.
And I think that's really interesting. And in the Scottish context in particular, we've seen YouGov polling, which for the first time in a decade put Labour in front of the SNP. But slightly deeper into that polling, we saw that voters were more likely to be neutral towards Labour than they were the Conservatives or Labour. And as we know, people go out and vote for something that they feel passionately about. And if you're neutral about something, maybe that doesn't want you make you want to go out and vote. Is that what you're indicating?
That's a really good point. Well, there's two points. One, you've posed the point that people may not go out and vote. So they might be dissatisfied with the Conservatives, but not happy to vote Labour or SNP. So we don't get a clear majority and people stay home. but then they disengage from the process, which is really bad for democracy. But also, the second point I'd add is it's just very turbulent. Probably voters haven't made up their mind because they're not yet convinced of the alternative product, of the alternative offering by Labour. But then thirdly, in the Scottish situation, you've got a three-way race, right? At the very least, you've got SNP, Labour and the Conservatives. So maybe people, you know, Conservative voters in Scotland won't be voting Conservative, but they don't want to go for Labour. Will they go for an SNP? Well, it depends, because SNP is a very distinctive brand and, of course, very much tied to independence. Conservative voters may not want that. They're unionist voters. They're union focused. They want the UK to continue. So what that, to me, what it says is, whilst the simple view is that Labour are going to rock it home and that's it and the election's done and dusted, and yes, the Conservative Party are not doing well, I don't think it's as simple as that. I think there's more turbulence. I think voters are not yet completely satisfied with one major party. They're not going to be, it's not necessarily a guaranteed swing going to happen towards the Labour Party. And so commentators and the political parties themselves, you know, they've got everything, the party's got everything to campaign for still, and they've still got work to do. Now, you might still get a Labour majority, but it won't be as big. But if the public aren't behind it, it's much harder for the new Labour Prime Minister, if that happens, to deliver positive change, to change things, to make, you know, dramatic impact on people's lives. So, yes, they might still win the election because people are so unhappy with the Conservatives. But it doesn't mean that they're going to have great support behind them, and that will make it harder to govern.
And the sort of unknown in this election across the UK is going to be the Reform Party, which is currently polling in Scotland at 7% above the Greens and the Liberal Democrats. In the UK, across the UK, it's polling much, much higher. How important a factor do you think that will be?
It's really hard to predict with, you know, minor parties and more independent parties. What I would say is, again, it contributes to the turbulence. It might be that they might, you know, reduce the votes for another party in certain key seats that then changes the overall result, even if they don't win it. They might pick up voters, you know, Conservative voters who don't want to vote Conservative anymore but don't want to go to Labour, would never consider the SNP. They might go for Reform. And so it dilutes the vote and it splits the vote. So again, it's turbulence. And it's, you can see situations, you know, historically, when I think about the 20 odd years I've studied elections, where neither major party has really captured the imagination or the trust or the respect of voters. And then you get the rise of independent or maverick or, you know, minor parties who you wouldn't normally expect to see. So again, we don't know, we can't predict, but it still further points to this election being a lot less certain than we might think from the headline polls.
And obviously when the election will be is purely in the gift of the Prime Minister. How much of an edge does that give the Conservatives?
On one hand, well, it's a double-edged sword. So it gives them the power to decide when to hold the election. And if, for example, they could do something majorly positive or something happens that's majorly positive between now and, say, an October election, and they call the election after that, then that's great. But they've got no guarantee that will happen, you know, unless they've got some major thing that they can promise that voters will believe between now and then that they can launch. But that's unlikely because they've been in power, so why haven't they done it before? And the other thing is things can go wrong, like you could have another natural disaster, you know, war could intensify in the Ukraine-Russia conflict and so on. So, and what we tend to see in these situations when parties are in government and they're unpopular is they tend to hold on to power for as long as they can in the hope things will get better. So it gives them some kind of tactical edge, but ultimately doesn't help them overcome a major strategic problem of having been in power, having been seen as incompetent because of change of leadership and potentially not having delivered on their promises.
And a lot of your research, and you've written a book, in fact, is on political staff and political advisors. What do you make of the current government's management of political staff and political advisors? Is there any criticisms you make, anything that you would endorse that they do?
What I would say is actually it's a problem area for all parties and all governments all around the world. It's actually not an issue of right-wing parties in particular. And that is that political staff and indeed politicians themselves are not prepared and trained and managed effectively in their roles. So that the voters vote them into power, politicians that is. They get into their office, they then appoint staff who work for them. All of this is taxpayer funded as it should be. It's democracy, that's how it works. But nobody trains them effectively on how to do their job. They might do a bit of training on how to use IT and how the formal processes of legislation work, but they don't train them on how to manage MPs, on how to manage staff, or staff how to manage staff. And so that means we've got a bunch of people in there who we've elected who are there to deliver on the promises that they've made to us. and they're not equipped to do the job. And in no other profession would you have that. You know, we wouldn't be operated on by surgeons who haven't been trained. We wouldn't ask somebody to come and build an extension or put a roof on a house who didn't know what they were doing. We wouldn't even go to the hairdresser if we didn't think they were trained and qualified. You know, we wouldn't let them cut our hair or dye our hair. So it causes lots of problems. And this is true of the world over. It's not just the Conservative government at the moment.
And do you think that's partly why we've seen in recent years a sort of rise in the number of complaints about inappropriate behaviour, sexual assault, things like that, by MPs towards staff?
Absolutely. I mean, and we do think that this is actually a historic issue and that it's been going on. You know, journalists have talked to me about it as well. It's not just, who've been involved in the parliamentary precinct. There's been issues with harassment and bullying and bad behaviour for a long time. But we've now also got mental health is on the agenda. And part of that is people are more comfortable in talking about these issues. But it's also, I think, been made worse by, you know, the introduction of the 24-hour media and social media, which means there's no breaks. So these have always been very demanding roles. People, both staffers, advisors and politicians, work incredibly long hours, even though the public probably don't give them credit for that because they don't see that. But then there's no break from it. And any job that's extremely high pressured, if you get no break from it, any mental health psychologist, occupational psychologist or HRM practitioner will tell you that's not a very good idea. So really the workplace conditions are very poor. And that means we don't get the best out of the people we elect to run our country and to put in changes that we want to see. And that's why a lot of things don't work very well. That's why parties don't deliver. So, I mean, any party preparing for government, and I know the UK Labour Party is at least considering this, should be thinking about how they're going to put it in place, better HRM practices, human resource management practices, to ensure that people get an orientation into what the job is, how to make it work, and how to look after themselves as well, so they can look after us, so they can make better quality decisions in what is a very pressured environment.
And a lot of people who aren't involved in politics might not realise what these political staffers, political advisors do. From your research, how important are they? What kind of decisions are they making?
The staffers and advisors are basically an extension of the politician. So although they're not elected directly, they help the politician do their job. Without that, you wouldn't get a response to your emails, to your letters. You know, they wouldn't be able to function basically because the job has expanded so much. So the advisors and staffers are there to, you know, extend the politician's capacity and carry out certain tasks for them. But they also, at the more senior level, play a role in informing the decisions that a politician makes. And, you know, the good ones, what they will do is they will question what the politician is thinking. They will help them achieve their goals, certainly, but they're not, despite the parodies in various TV programs, they're not actually yes prime minister kind of men and women. They're actually their job that is there to challenge them, say, but have you thought about this and have you thought about that, and what about these groups in society, have you considered these? They also do a lot of backroom work in building relationships, particularly across the party divide, and that helps, you know, particularly transformative legislation on climate change or identity issues or rights, human rights. It helps those the kind of issues and legislation get through. So it really helps promote social change or more innovative policies that are new to the political system. And they do a lot of backroom work that is less about, you know, dirty politics and more about building trust and positive relationships and dialogue with people across the political spectrum so they can get things through in Parliament. Because they're without them, so they actually play a really, really important role.
So Keir Starmer has appointed Sue Gray, a former senior civil servant, as his chief of staff. Probably most familiar to our listeners is the Grand Inquisitor who investigated the number 10 rule breaking COVID lockdown parties. She's been a civil servant since 1975 before she left that role to become Labour's chief of staff. Most recently, she was director general in the Cabinet Office for Propriety and Ethics. It is a topic you've researched really extensively. How unique is it to have somebody with that much civil service experience become a Labour appointed political advisor?
I don't know whether she's the only one, but it is quite unique because often what happens is political parties, when they're campaigning for power, build up really effective campaign teams, you know, who are involved in communication and branding and marketing, but they don't have the experience and understanding of government. So when a party gets into government, it then struggles because there isn't the orientation in place, there isn't the training in place. So this is actually quite a smart move by Keir Starmer. It means he's bringing in expertise from somebody who actually understands how government works. Because even though we elect the politicians and they get into power and theoretically they have all the power, in practice, they need to be able to work with the civil service because the civil service are the people who make it happen on the ground. And they turn, you know, policies into legislation and legislation into actual practices in the public service and so on. So it's really smart. particularly as well as she obviously has the ability, she understands the issues that can happen in Downing Street as well. So my hope is that they are actually putting in place better HRM practices so that when they get in, if they get into government, they're much more ready to hit the ground running and make that work. And it's something for the other parties, the Conservative Party, Liberal Democrats, SNP as well, to think about. Whether it's, it doesn't have to be appointing somebody as your chief of staff who's a former civil servant, but it's just making sure there is within the party unit and the core political leaders team that understanding of how government works and people who can work across divides where you've got politicians, political advisors or staffers and civil servants, and they all need to work together as and parliamentary staff as well. They all need to work together to make government work.
And again, it's probably something we all underestimate is just how huge government is and just having that experience of someone who understands government, understands, you know, the different departments, the sort of where people have their jobs and what their jobs are. Just having that experience must be proven invaluable.
Absolutely huge, because it's not enough to have great ideas. I mean, that's the first point, and yes, politicians should have that, but you need to actually turn them to, you know, legislation and policies that actually turn into reality. And for that, you need to understand the committee process, the not just the formal, this is how a law is made, but how do you get people on board? Because even though we may elect the Conservative, Labour, Liberal, SNP or whoever to run government, they still have to get all their policies and major legislation through Parliament. And that's a good thing, because Parliament subjects it to scrutiny and people from the opposition parties will say, well, what about this and what about that? And they actually therefore prevent, you know, bad legislation going through and hopefully help good legislation get better and make it work better on the ground. So it's a good thing. But to manage that through the process and ensure that the original ideas, the original vision to make the country a better place isn't completely lost and isn't watered down, that's where you need political staff and advisors who understand how it works and understand how to get that original vision through intact, where it's hopefully improved and not completely destroyed.
And at the start, you mentioned, obviously, we have the Scottish election coming up in 2 years' time. How important do you think the general election will be and the result to the general election will be to the Scottish election?
It's hard to say. At the end of the day, Scotland is its own unique, you know, country in that respect. It's a devolved parliament. So if, you know, if the Conservatives remained in power, it would probably help S&P because they can be, you know, come and vote for us to give us a way of check on the Conservative government. But equally, it could work that way with Labour. If Labour win the UK election after 2 years are doing really well, that could help Scottish Labour in the Scottish devolved elections. But equally, if they're not, if after 2 years people feel like they haven't fulfilled their promises, or worse, things have gone wrong and they've got scandals and they've got problems and mismanagement of whatever crisis comes our way in those 2 years, then it could backfire and obviously harm Scottish Labour's chances. It might help the Scottish Conservatives if the UK Conservative Party is out of power. So there will be some relationship between the two. But there's still going to be, how's the SNP party been in government for another 2 years? And how are they delivering for the people of Scotland on Scottish issues on a day-to-day basis up here far removed from Westminster?
We've seen a bit of this already, but talking about the Scottish context in particular and how it's sometimes quite challenging for the UK parties to campaign in Scotland, because a lot of the bread and butter issues that they would campaign on, the NHS, housing, transport, are all devolved. And obviously the UK government can't legislate in these areas. How tricky is that for the parties in terms of their messaging?
That's a good point. They have to be very tactical and constructive about it. I mean, one thing I've seen parties do in other systems around the world, which are a bit more complex, like Scotland's, is they often say, well, give us a voice in Parliament. So, you know, vote for us. Because I mean, some of the things the UK government does will still influence Scotland regardless. So, you know, it's make sure we've got a voice there to speak on your behalf in the UK Parliament. And so it's kind of a tactical move to make sure that Scotland is represented. But yeah, it is hard. It is different. There's no doubt about that. But still, the experience of voters on a day-to-day basis is what they're going to care about. And to some degree, even though there is technically a legal distinction between what's a devolved issue and what isn't, voters still, they don't live their life in a devolved versus Westminster Parliament, right? So whoever they're voting for in the UK election, they want them to represent their views on every issue that's important to them.
The SNP have said that they're going to use this election as essentially a referendum on independence, and that if they get a majority of seats, that's 29 seats, they'll use that as a mandate for independence to begin negotiations, is how they frame it, for independence. How risky is that, a strategy for voters who who maybe want to vote SNP, but, you know, want it to be about something more than just independence.
It's obviously not going to be ideal for those voters that you've just described, because they're not looking for that to happen then. It might put them off. But I suppose the SNP might be, the, you know, one possibility is the SNP are thinking, well, those voters aren't going to vote for us anyway, or they're less likely to. Whereas if we give, if we take that position that, that you just described, of saying if we vote for us, we're going to that be taking that as a vote for support for independence, and we're going to campaign for that within the UK system, then it gives voters who do want independence a reason to vote for the SNP. So they might draw in Conservative and Labour voters in Scotland who are pro-independence that way. And it gives people a rationale. Otherwise, why would you vote SNP for the UK election? Because what can the SNP MPs do in a Westminster system? You know, it's much harder to have a voice within a massive UK system. And that's why we have devolution in the first place. So it's clever short-term tactics, but you're right that it could put off some voters but who aren't pro-independence. But that's always the dilemma for the SNP, isn't it? If you're hung around in a very fixed position on we want independence, then it's not so good.
None of the new UK parties have said that they'll accept that as a mandate thus far, which we probably wouldn't expect them to. But some of the sort of worst polling for the SNP has suggested they could get fewer than 29 seats. I mean, the UK parties post-election where the SNP got fewer than 29 seats could legitimately say, well, that's a second referendum that the voters have rejected.
That is a good point,
independence.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be quite a smart move by them, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it is. So that's a good point. So it is, in that respect, it's a risky strategy, particularly to say 29 seats and make it so high. And what if they get 28? They're not going to do it. They're playing games. And with playing games, it's always, you can sometimes have massive short-term hits, but it's also a risk if you don't lose. And then that can damage your credibility going forward to the Scottish election as well, because they wouldn't be able to then necessarily campaign on independence or being at the forefront of the situation if they just already had not enough votes according to their own rules as well. So, I mean, in some ways it's savvy tactical marketing, but on the other hand, it may be imprudent long-term strategizing, and that it could come back to bite them, I think. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that.
And something that just lastly that we've seen quite a lot of so far is how important party management has been for all the leaders, actually. SNP, Hamza Yousaf's the independents, that was quite a lot about party management. The Conservatives have obviously huge issues with party management, Labour as well. And how much a distraction can that be?
Massive distraction, because it just, you know, the media will, and the public will always pick up on any mismanagement by parties. For sensible reasons, in that if parties can't manage their own organisation, how can they run a government? So government is bigger than a political party, bigger than an individual party. So it kind of points to, you know, concerns about competence and ability to do the job. So there are reasons for that. But so it's really distracting. And it's hard managing a political party, just as it is hard running a government department or even just Downing Street or any organization. And often politicians, again, are not trained in how to manage parties effectively. And of course, the more mismanagement stories you get, it tends to affect your polling. And then people, voters doubt everything else that you promise. And it starts to put chinks in the armor of your brand, your political brand as well, for competence and trustworthiness. And then if you go down in polls, then actually it's more likely to be more disunity, more internal debate as politicians start questioning the leadership and so on. So it is a big issue. And we've had issues recently, you know, with Scottish Labour candidate being suspended by the Scottish Labour Party, along with, you know, prior to that, some UK Labour candidates as well being suspended. And that, of course, also undermines the Labour Party brand. As we said at the start of the podcast, that headline polling is just headline. It doesn't tell the whole story. And there are all these chinks in Labour's armour that are being knocked away, that they're going to have to work very hard to try and stop that. Otherwise, it could definitely reduce the public support for their brand.
And just lastly, for our listeners who are interested in polling and interested in looking at polling, who are going to be following it throughout the campaign and throughout until the general election, what would your top tip be on sort of looking at the polling and understanding it beyond the headline figures?
That's a really good question. And the main thing is to look at long-term trends. So don't just look at, you know, polling takes a snapshot of opinion on one time, one place. And that, but it doesn't tell you where people are going to go in the future. So some of the best ways to understand it are, first of all, to look back and look at what the overall trend is over the last 6 months, but then also look at more detailed polling, which there is a lot available online with YouGov, but Ipsos Mori and other organisations as well, which are, you know, are Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak or Hazma Yousaf, are they seen as trustworthy? Are they seen as in touch with the public? Do people believe that they are competent and able to deliver on their those promises? Look at more detailed polling. You know, are the Labour Party seen as representing the middle class or the poor or the Conservative Party and so on? So just go and look at more detailed polling than just the headlines. Because at the end of the day, each constituency has it. It's going to be voted on separately. There are different systems in place. So the overall headline poll tells you everybody's views merged together. But actually on election night, it's going to be all broken down. And that's where we may see some unexpected results.
Great. Thank you. And thanks to Professor Lise Marshmint for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jennifer Lise Marshmint of Dundee University speaking with Alistair Clark for the latest episode of The Stooshy. We'll be back next week for more. Until then, subscribe to The Press and Journal, The Courier, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed.